Hey everyone, welcome back to Citywide Blackout, your home for music, movies, and more. I'm your host, Max Bowen. In her debut novel, Closer to Fine, Jody Rosenfeld brings a coming-of-age tale set in Boston, where she lived for many years. Along with a background for the story, we talk about her main character, Rachel, and the many teachers she meets. Jody talks about the editing process and the lessons learned by this debut writer. We also look at She Writes Press, which published the book, and what it was like working with them. My next guest is author Jody Rosenfeld for her new and first book, Closer to Fine, recently released through She Writes Press. Jody, welcome to the show. It's great to have you here.
It's great to be here, Max. Thank you so much.
Of course, of course. So, first question I have for you is your career is as a clinical psychologist. So how did you go to adding novelist to your resume?
So that's actually a more complicated question than you think. You're right. I've been a clinical psychologist for the past 20 years. I have a small private practice outside of Philadelphia, but I'm actually putting that on hold and starting rabbinical school in the fall. I'm going to be going to school to be a rabbi. So when I think about the big transition happening in my life and my work life, it's actually from psychologist to rabbi. And the book, interestingly enough, has been a passion project. It's something I've been working on for almost a decade. And when I look at the story itself, and we can talk more about what that is, it's actually an interesting bridge for me. The book itself bridges both psychology, therapy and psychology. There's a lot about that in the story, and Jewish identity. So really the novel itself has served sort of as an interesting bridge between these two careers that I'm currently transitioning between. This is my debut novel. I don't know if there will be other books, but I haven't thought of myself as an author per se. And I guess that's a hat I need to start proudly claiming, because the book just came out this week and it's been so exciting to see it on the shelf in bookstores.
What was your reaction on release day? Because I know that some writers will just be freaking out like crazy. Others will be totally on cloud nine.
I think I was on cloud nine. I had a really great release day, but I do have to say it was a little bit anticlimactic because some places released it early. So I have lots of friends who ordered it through places like bookshop.com or Amazon. And I'm not actually sure who got them early, but people were contacting me up until 2 weeks before the release date saying, oh, I just got it in the mail. So fun, ironically, by the time the release date came, it was a little bit of an anticlimactic moment, but I was actually very excited. It's been a really fun week.
I can imagine how that conversation went. Like, hey, I got my book. How?
And I was like, how? Who gave it to you?
No, you didn't.
What do you mean? But I guess it was just ready a little early. And so some places release it, whenever they get it, which is, fine. That's been fine as well. Mm-hmm. Really exciting to hear back from people as they finish it.
Mm-hmm. Now, are you planning any kind of readings or signings? Because I know now those kinds of things can actually happen.
Well, so we're in sort of a funny place, right? Like they're just starting to happen at some bookstores, but not everywhere. So the bookstore in my hometown here of Phoenixville, Pennsylvania, actually hasn't quite started doing things in person yet. So on my release date, I did a virtual launch with them, which was great. And, in some ways, maybe it was even better than doing it in person because people from all around could be there and, it wasn't limited to local, people who were just local. Yeah, you're right. I think as things start to open up, maybe there will be some opportunities for in-person signings and events. I would love to come up to Boston. That would be great because the story, the whole story actually takes place in Somerville. I would love to be there and be able to promote it as well.
Well, Boston would certainly love to have you. In fact, actually, the Boston Book Festival, which happens in October, is apparently a go this year.
Oh, that's great to know. That's mm-hmm. great. Yeah, I know mm-hmm. It wasn't in the past the last year, so that's great.
Are there any book expos in your area that you're hoping to be a part of once those things can resume?
That's a good question. I don't, because they've been so shut down for the past year and a half, I don't know what is opening when, but you certainly are inspiring me to look into it more seriously because, right, as things open up, it's a great time to jump into those events.
Exactly. And that's really part, I think, of what it means to be an indie author. You have to be your own marketing person. So you've got to
absolutely
go to those festivals, go to the expos. You've got to basically put yourself out there. Is that kind of thing hard for you or easy?
I would say it's easy. I'm an extrovert by nature, and I love talking about the book and I love sharing it with people. So I think that's easy. I am working with a publicist group called Books Forward, and they've been great helping me get the word out as well. But you're right, it does take a certain amount of initiative to, you know, get your book out into people's hands.
I would be so bad at this. I would be like so nervous about like, hi, my name's Max. I'm a writer. You should check my book out.
Right. If you want.
Yeah, exactly.
No pressure.
I definitely don't have that salesman ability.
Yeah, you do have to put yourself out there. And it's interesting. You know, a friend of mine was asking me recently if it was scary, this process of writing this book. And my response was that it wasn't scary at all. It was exhilarating, but this part is scary, right? So this moment of letting it go, you know, kind of like a bird flying out of the nest, like letting it out into the world, into people's hands, that's terrifying because, of course, you know, you've relinquished all control and it's out there for people to comment on or to, you know, whether they like it or dislike it. And you just have to sort of sit back and let that happen. So yeah, there's something scary about that for sure.
I think almost a little bit of a letdown too, because you've been in this world for so long, in some cases for some writers for years, and it's over. Like the journey's over. It's done. It's out there. It's like, well, now what do I do with myself?
Right. That's true. Luckily for me, because I'm starting a new career path, that hasn't been so much of a problem. It's more like, when am I going to fit things in? But I know what you mean. I mean, this has been about 8.5 years in the making, lots of years of editing and re-editing. It's really a slow process, but it's been wonderful. And I'm just amazed to kind of finally be at this moment.
Given that you worked on it for so long, what kept you motivated to keep writing, especially as, you know, the months and the years pass?
Right. So that's actually a great question. You know, what worked for me was taking breaks. I think anytime you're working on a project for a long time, you get so sucked into it that you lose all perspective, right? You lose the ability to be objective in any way. And when I would feel that happening, I would put it down for 6 months and not let myself read it or work on it at all. And then I would pick it back up and try to start fresh. And that was really helpful. It was, you know, a nice way to kind of approach it anew. So yeah, I would take lots of breaks, and working with different editors over the years was helpful. You know, people have to do different pairs of eyes, see different things. So that would kind of renew the excitement and the motivation, hearing different people's perspectives on it.
What were some of the reactions once it was released?
Well, the reactions have been great, and they've been really fun. You know, the first reaction to my book, and this has been happening for years before anyone has ever read it, comes from the people, you know, people in my life, my friends and family, as I describe to them what the book's about. And I can do that for you as well. You know, they look at me and they go, so is this about you? You know, so is this memoir? Is this autobiography? And that was everyone's first response. And the truth is, it's very much based on my own experience, but it is fiction. So yes, there are lots of things I have in common with my protagonist. But it took a lot of convincing for me to say to people, no, it's not, this is not my diary. This is not my experience. But yes, of course, you know, we write about what we know. I think that's one of the first things we learn in any writing class, even going back to, you know, grade school, write about what you know, what you're familiar with. And so I started in that place. But the fun part was being able to take it in new directions, you know, to kind of imagine if things had been different.
Let's look at the story. This focuses on Rachel Levine.
Let me say something about Rachel Levine before you go any further. Yep. This is another. So people often ask me, does this have anything to do with Dr. Rachel Levine, who is Biden's pick, recent pick for Assistant Secretary of Health? And before she began her, you know, federal position, she was the Secretary of Health for the state of Pennsylvania, for the Commonwealth of Pennsylvania, which is where I live. And the name is absolutely coincidental. So when I started working on it 8.5 years ago and I named the character Rachel Levine, I had never heard of Rachel Levine, the public servant. And then when she sort of came into the public eye in Pennsylvania, I thought, well, that's coincidental, but it's fine. And now, of course, she's become somewhat of a household name. She's the first trans woman to be in, you know, such a high position in any administration. So she's become somewhat of a household name. And I've had this question a lot, like, oh, is your character based on her? And actually, no, unfortunately, it's just a coincidence. And if I had known she was going to become so famous, I might have given my character a different last name. So I apologize if that causes anyone confusion. So Rachel is a young woman in her mid-20s, and she's embarking on what today we would probably call the tasks of adulting. You know, we would say she's adulting. But this book takes place in the 1990s, and I actually don't think the term adulting was something we used back then. She is coming into her adult self as a young professional, as a Jewish woman, as a bisexual woman, as a romantic partner, as an adult daughter, and as an adult granddaughter. She actually finds herself in the somewhat unusual situation of becoming housemates with her elderly grandfather, her Zeta. Zeta is the Yiddish word for grandfather. And so much of the novel revolves around their shifting intergenerational dynamics. And ultimately, it's a story that looks at the question of how we deal with the uncertainty in our adult lives and the anxiety that that uncertainty brings up for all of us. So the people in Rachel's life respond to their own anxiety in different ways. Some of them avoid, some of them use denial. But this is really her journey about figuring out how she wants to manage her own anxiety around being an adult in the world. So that's a kind of a snapshot. And, you know, for myself, I wear a lot of hats. I'm a psychologist, and Rachel is learning to be a psychologist. She's going to graduate school in the book. I identify as bisexual and as part of the queer community, and I'm in love with Judaism, you know, which is why I'm starting rabbinical school. So I can understand why many people said to me, you know, is this a book about you? Because certainly it does start in those places, and it brings together, you know, those passions of mine.
How would you say Rachel and you differ?
Oh, that's a great question, Max. Thank you. It's a good question. First of all, I think Rachel is far healthier than I was when I was in my 20s. You know, the book is about someone in her 20s, but I didn't write it until I was in my 40s. And I think I needed those two decades of space to look back and have some perspective on what the kind of development that happens when we're in our 20s. I think for me, when I was that age, I made many more mistakes than she makes. She has an ability to, well, she really grows. I can say that throughout the course, you know, the book takes place over a handful of years. And over that time, she grows tremendously. And I think probably in more ways than I did at that age. She is a little bit more of a risk taker, I think, than I am. And that was kind of fun in terms of the writing, because of course you can take something that starts with who you are and imagine yourself in any number of ways. So, you know, to make Rachel kind of start with some similarities and then have her make different kinds of choices than the ones I made in my life or that, you know, I might make was really fun. I mean, that's a fun exercise to do. So I would say she's a little healthier and a little more adventurous than I was at that point.
You mentioned her anxiety. How strong a presence is this in her life?
It's very strong. It's very strong. I actually had one reader say, wow, this is a book all about anxiety. I don't disagree with that statement. You know, Rachel struggles with her own anxiety at every point throughout the course of the novel. She is learning to be a psychologist and she's working with people who have anxiety, but she also enters her own therapy during the course of the book. And we get to see the therapeutic relationship sort of from both sides of the couch. We get to see her working with clients and then we get to see her as a client working with her own therapist on her own anxiety. Yeah, it's very central, you know, and I think it's something we all identify with. I think we are, we are a human race of anxious people. And so I think that's something that a lot of people will relate to as they read her experience.
How would you say her anxiety like affects her, especially given her age?
That's a really good question, especially given her age. She second guesses herself a lot. And I think that's something we all can relate to. You know, that question of, am I being understood? Am I saying the right thing? Am I making the right impressions on people? You know, we have a habit of being our own worst critic. And I think Rachel is very much her own worst critic in the novel. I would also say that her anxiety holds her back in some ways around coming out. So one of her struggles is that she's out to certain people in her life, but she's not out to her grandfather. And she tells us this in the very first chapter. She says that when she let her parents know that she'd be moving to Somerville to move in with her grandfather, her mother forbids her to come out to him. She says it will kill him. And Rachel really takes this in and believes that she could actually kill her grandfather if he were to know, and really struggles with that throughout the novel, struggles with what does it mean for me to lie to him versus what does it mean for me to be my true self? Would he love me if he knew exactly who I was? And that's something that I think people who, you know, who come out of the closet, I guess this is true at any age, but who are young enough to still have grandparents, this is often a really tough situation. You know, I hear it again and again, and I experienced it in my own life, this idea of, okay, but your grandparents can't know. They won't understand. They're from a different generation. And so, and I think people still struggle with that today, even though their grandparents are now of a newer generation than the one in the book. You know, the one in the book, it's the mid-1990s. Her Zeta was born in, you know, probably like 1910, you know? And so there's this idea that, you know, people born at a certain time or of a certain generation don't understand. And we have to protect them from things they don't understand. But I think people struggle when people come out, even now, struggle with those same questions about grandparents and what older people can accept later in life. So that's certainly one of her main anxious struggles, I would say.
One thing I'm curious about, and I know nothing about this, so this may be a dumb question, but bisexuality and Jewish culture, do those two go well together?
That's a really excellent question. It's not a stupid question at all. So let me say something about what Jewish culture means, because that's a complicated idea, right? Judaism has many sort of strands, so to speak. So there's Orthodox Judaism. There's, you know, very strictly traditional Orthodox Jews. Then there's something called conservative Judaism, which is less strict, but still very, very traditional. And then there's things like Reform Judaism and Reconstructionist Judaism and Renewal Judaism. And those are more modern types of movements within the under the Jewish umbrella that it's not that they're less religious, it's that they're more progressive in terms of social things, in terms of political things. They tend to be very heavily focused on social change and social justice. So when we think about the idea of, you know, Jewish culture, it really depends who you're talking about. You know, it really depends what group of Jews you're talking about when you ask that question. So, and this is a struggle that Rachel experiences in the book. So her grandfather identifies as a conservative Jewish person. He belongs to a synagogue that's part of the conservative movement, and it's the 1990s. And at that point, rabbis in that movement would not perform same-sex marriages. There was a lot of taboo around same-sex relationships. And so I think it was she was right to be concerned that her grandfather might not accept this. And yet, in the 1990s, the conservative movement was starting to take a turn on that issue. And there's a scene where she talks with the rabbi at her grandfather's synagogue, and the rabbi assures her, even though the movement has not officially changed their position on that yet, we are working to make that happen. And since then, that has happened. That has happened very much. And so the conservative movement now would gladly perform a marriage for a same-sex couple. In those other more progressive movements, that's been the case for a very long time. So outside of Orthodox Judaism, I would say that being bisexual or lesbian or gay or trans or any number of identities under the LGBTQ umbrella do go well in Jewish culture. I think there's a lot of acceptance. I think there's a lot of welcoming and inclusion. And I think there was less of it 2 decades ago. So one of the things we see, you know, I think it's really important that the book take place in the 1990s, because it would be different if it didn't. If Closer to Fine took place in the present day, the story would be altered, because sexual politics have changed and religious institutions have changed. And there's been so much evolving around those things, especially as they intersect, that I think it would change the story very much. So it really is specific to how those things connect in the 1990s.
Why set this in the 90s?
I have to be, you know, perfectly honest. I was in my 20s in the 90s, living in Somerville, Massachusetts. And so I started it again with what I knew. But I also really wanted to capture things about that time. I was really into the folk music scene, you know, going to Club Passim or going to the Somerville Theater. And of course, the title Closer to Fine, it comes from the Indigo Girls song Closer to Fine, which I think they released in like maybe 1990 or 1989. But the Indigo Girls are referenced in the novel. So is Dar Williams quite a lot, actually. There's several references to Dar Williams concerts and things like that. So I'm nostalgic, I would say, for sort of the queer folk scene of Boston in the 1990s. And I really wanted to bring that into the novel. And so there's a lot of that. I think that's just really where I wanted it to be.
I am definitely loving that because I lived in Boston for about 8 years and I loved hanging out in Somerville and Cambridge. I love the music scene there, the art scene.
Mm-hmm.
So when you were writing this, was this a lot of like diving back into the past? You have to kind of like reconnect with some of these things?
Absolutely. Although I have to be honest, I don't know that I've ever lost connection. I still listen to the same, much of the same music that I listened to then, you know, I listen to now. You know, my kids have had to learn, you know, a lot of Sean Colvin and a lot of, you know, a lot of, you know, Dar Williams and the Indigo Girls and all the people I listened to then. So it wasn't so much diving back as much as just saying like, hey, don't forget this. It's this incredible time in music, especially for women, you know, women singer-songwriters. So being able to like really elevate them in the book was fun.
Oh, yeah. I tend to think that the 90s were some of the best times for music because, and the funny thing is that a lot of those artists are still playing today. They're still touring
absolutely
today, which
absolutely
to me is remarkable, frankly.
Yeah. In fact, there's a concert I just saw advertised. I think it's on Father's Day, which unfortunately makes it impossible for me to get there that day. But at a farm in New Jersey, the Indigo Girls and Dar Williams are playing together, which I thought was wonderful, and especially as the book is releasing. So I wish I could be at that concert.
You know, one thing that I was really curious about, given that this is your first book and that it doesn't seem like you have like a writing background, mm-hmm. why this particular topic? Like you could have gone anywhere with any kind of genre, any kind of story type. Why did this wind up being the one you settled for?
Oh, that's a great question. Well, you know, again, starting with what I know, right? So I picked a story about a young woman who is not so different from the young woman I was, you know, when I was in my 20s. But also it's the kind of literature I like to read, right? So I like to read a lot of women's fiction, a lot of coming of age fiction, especially, you know, not coming of age in terms of young adult, but in terms of what's sometimes called in the publishing world, new adult fiction, which is sort of specifically looking at that time of development of being in one's 20s. So I tend to gravitate towards those books myself. And I think it was just natural to want to write in that same genre.
So no epic fantasy in your future?
Not at all. No epic fantasy in my future, I have to say. So, I'd be terrible at it, actually.
And Rachel will not be going on to become like a murder mystery detective.
Absolutely not.
No, high tech thrillers here.
That's right. No, none of that happening.
Do you see this as kind of a one-off for you?
You know, I'm absolutely going to stick with writing. I don't know that will mean I'll write another novel. But again, you know, listen, life, things happen that we don't predict. So I'm open to whatever happens. But I am excited when I think about my upcoming adventure into rabbinical school of having lots of opportunities for writing and for creative writing as well. I'm going to be attending the Reconstructionist Rabbinical College in Philadelphia. And the Reconstructionist movement is really innovative when it comes to things like creative liturgy or ritual writing. And there's a lot of opportunity there to create through words, spiritual experiences for people. So I'm excited to continue writing and who knows, you know, my doors are not closed to anything right now.
I want to talk about teachers because this book certainly has a lot of teachers for Rachel, her grandfather, her progressive rabbi, a worldly girlfriend, a wise supervisor, and an insightful therapist. What are some of the lessons that they teach her and how does she take them? Because being in your 20s, you think you know everything.
That's right. You think you know everything. And I think at moments you think you know everything and at moments you think you know nothing. You actually know more than you think you do. it's interesting. Rachel learns from so many different people in your life, like you just said, different kinds of lessons, you know, from her grandfather. Her grandfather is sort of her character foil in a way. He represents tradition. He likes to do things the way they've always been done. And Rachel is really excited about progress and being innovative and progressive. And so the two of them butt heads sometimes, but I think there's a way in which he teaches her about meeting in the middle. You know, she has, in order to have a relationship with him, which is very important to her, she has to meet him in the middle. She has to find common ground. And I think that's something she learns, not just from him, but from being in a relationship with him. Her therapist, she ends up finding a wonderful therapist named Kevin, who teaches her not only about herself, but about the craft of psychotherapy. So she's in school learning to be a therapist, and yet I think she learns more from her own experience being Kevin's client. And that actually comes up at one point in the book. She's interviewing for an internship, and the interviewers ask her a question about how she views therapeutic work. And all of a sudden she finds herself saying things that she never thought she would say. It just, as it comes out of her mouth, she's shocked. And she realizes in that moment that she's sort of channeling her own therapist, that she has learned more from the experience of being with him in the therapeutic relationship than she has from her textbooks, you know? And that's kind of an aha moment for her. Her girlfriend, Liz, and you know, the romance between Rachel and Liz is really at the heart of the book. Liz is just a little bit older. She's about 4 years older than Rachel. She's had a little bit more life experience. So she's lived abroad. And this is something that's apparent between them from day one, that Liz is a little bit worldlier, knows a little bit more, a little more street smart than Rachel. And Rachel feels that acutely. She feels like the young one. She feels like the inexperienced one in the relationship. But over time, as they grow together, there are ways in which Rachel is actually the more mature one, and Rachel actually takes more risks. And that's a moment where she kind of learns that there are other ways to be worldly and mature. You know, Liz doesn't own all of that, but she has her own things that she brings to the table. And so there's a lot of learning, I think, that takes place in that relationship.
Now, I believe you mentioned earlier that Rachel is still sort of discovering who she is as a bisexual woman. Is Liz her first same-sex relationship?
It's not, but Liz identifies as lesbian, and that actually causes some friction between the two of them. And this is something, you know, it's interesting. I'm not as well-versed on how true this still is today, but this was certainly true in the 1990s from my own experience. There were certain stereotypes about bisexual people, and I think they do still exist, that bisexuals are fence-sitters or, you know, they want to have their cake and eat it too. They can't commit, this kind of thing. So that both straight people and gay and lesbian people sort of saw bisexuals as not quite trustworthy, you know, not really relationship material because they couldn't commit or they couldn't be with one person. You know, they couldn't be monogamous, all of this. And so that some of that plays out between Rachel and Liz, and they realize on their very first date that there's sort of an awkward moment where Rachel says something like, oh, well, actually, the last person I dated was a guy. So, and Liz kind of looks up and says, oh, so you're bi? You know, and there's this awkward tension. And Rachel says, yeah, is that a problem? And she says, no, it's not a problem. And actually, you know, it ends up being something that they revisit. So no, it's not her first girlfriend, but it is the first time she encounters this kind of friction as being a bisexual woman with a lesbian woman.
Of all the different teachers, who would you say is the most impactful for Rachel?
Who is the most impactful? I think, you know, in this, this answer might change depending on my mood, but in this very moment, I want to say it's Liz. And again, I think there's a difference between saying Liz is the important teacher or the relationship with Liz is the important teacher. And I think it's the relationship that's really the teacher. It's the dynamic between them and what she learns from the connection between them that I think teaches her the most. So it's not that Liz is this, you know, wise woman who imparts knowledge to Rachel. It's that Rachel grows through the relationship itself.
It sounds like you were already pretty familiar with every aspect of this book, the setting, the people, the encounters, and the relationships. But was there any kind of research you had to do before you could actually start writing or any kind of world building?
Good question. There wasn't a lot because, again, I placed it in a place that I knew. I knew that this book had to take place in Somerville because I spent all of my 20s pretty much living there. And I just knew it was the right setting, you know, and that the 1990s was the right setting. So I didn't have to research per se, but there were times where I had to go back and remind myself, you know, Rachel drives this beat up car. And I thought, oh, what kind of car would she drive? And I had to kind of go back and look at, you know, what would be an old car that she could, you know, that she could be, you know, driving across country at one point. And so little moments like that, but for the most part, having lived there during that time, yeah, the research was often my own memories.
I want to talk about Boston culture back then, because when I lived in Boston, this was in 2007. But what was it like for you?
Well, I was there as a student. So I actually grew up in Connecticut, and I went to Tufts University as an undergrad. So I moved up to Tufts. And then I stayed after Tufts. I moved to an apartment outside of Union Square in Somerville, and I stayed there for another 6 years. And I was in graduate school for four of those 6 years in Boston. For me, Boston was a college scene. It was really about students and music and lectures and poetry slams and things like that. Yeah, I remember that feeling of things getting much quieter in the summer. You know, when students would go home, that Boston would become a quieter place, and that was actually lovely in many ways. And then it would get exciting in the fall when so many people would flood back in. And I wonder if I mean, I'm assuming Boston still feels that way in many ways, or if that was much because I was a student and that was the lens at which through which I viewed it. But certainly, yeah, Boston, you know, and even though I'm older now, I'm almost 50, I love it. And I love it's my favorite place to visit, you know, and my dearest friends are there. And probably if I could live anywhere in the world, I'd go back to Boston.
I can say it was much the same when I was there. Very arts centric, very music centric, very college centric too. And likewise, in the summertime, the place was super quiet. And it was weird because, like, that was, of course, the big tourist time, but that did not make up for the lack of students. I think it's a
point. That's right. Yeah. That sounds right.
Summertime, dead quiet. Yeah. Fall, it just goes crazy time.
Yeah, absolutely.
You mentioned Club SCM, of course, one of the more well-known music venues in Boston. Where else did you like to go for fun?
Oh, that's, gosh. So, you know, Davis Square is such a fun place now. It's so much more developed and happening now than it was in the 90s. I think in the 90s, it was still fun. There was still the Somerville Theater, but it wasn't sort of the cultural, you know, mecca that it is now. You know, now when I visit, everyone wants to go to Davis Square and you know, either eat there or go to a cafe there or hang out. And it wasn't quite as big a deal then. But I did spend a lot of time there because it's so close to the Tufts campus. You know, a lot of time, I think I spent most of my time probably in Harvard Square, I would say, you know, going to places, you're challenging me to remember names of places, but there's some of them that I mentioned in the book. So, and of course I'm going to blank on them right now, but certain restaurants, you know, and we ate a ton of Indian food. And I just remember Central Square having the best Indian restaurants. And I talk about that in the book too, that Liz and Rachel often go to their favorite Indian place in Central Square. So for me, it was mostly, yeah, it was Somerville and Cambridge. I don't know that I went downtown quite that often. You know, I think I was happy being on the other side of the river and sort of being in Somerville and Cambridge for the most part.
Now, I know that every book undergoes a ton of revisions and edits before you get to the final product. Did you happen to work with an editor or a group of beta readers prior to publication?
Sure. So a little bit of both. I ended up hiring a really wonderful freelance editor, Julie Mizanchek. She used to work for a couple of different big publishing houses in New York City and worked on some very well-known books. And then he decided to freelance on her own. And she's someone I ended up connecting with when she was living in Brooklyn. And she was really the person who probably helped shape the book the most. She was really instrumental in helping me move it from a story that was telling to showing. And that's something we also learned when we were little. I don't know if you remember that. And, you know, in school, our teachers would say, show, don't tell. You know, have the characters show us what they're doing, not just tell us about what they're doing. And not having a formal writing background, you know, that was a mistake I made again and again. And she was really instrumental in helping shift it to a story full of scenes, you know, scenes of action. I remember her telling me, go back to the beginning and pretend you're writing it as a script to be filmed. You know, like, I want there to be movement in each scene. So we want to see the characters doing things and saying things and that it could actually be scripted. And that was probably the best advice I had ever gotten. The other thing was, and I think this is so important for any time someone works with an editor, she fell in love with Rachel. And that's how I knew she was the right person for me to work with. She read a draft and she said, I just love Rachel. She said, I just want to hear more from her. Like, I miss her. How's Rachel? And, you know, almost as if she were real. And that's how I knew she was the right person to work with, because she connected so well with the protagonist. And I really trusted her, implicitly. And then over the years, sure, there were other readers, friends and colleagues who would read parts and give me feedback. And then I ended up working with this wonderful publisher, She Writes Press. And She Writes is an indie press that really champions women debut writers. And they are different. They're so different from traditional publishing houses in that they create community. So all of the women who had book launches, for example, in spring of 2021 with me, we became a cohort, and we supported each other and we met on Zoom and and these are women of all different ages from all over the country. And we really supported each other through our writing and our editing and our publishing. I feel so fortunate to have worked with them as well.
I have talked to so many authors recently who work with She Writes. It's amazing.
Yeah?
They're just, it's really a range of stories too. It's not just like one type of story. It's like
absolutely
all kinds.
Absolutely. Yeah. There are a number of women who write memoir, who publish memoir through She Writes, but also, all the genres you were listing earlier, from fantasy to mystery, to cookbooks. I mean, there are people who write all sorts of things, and it's been exciting to work with so many different women and so many different books.
What would you say was the most important lesson from the entire process?
This is going to be hard, but I think I'm going to say trusting my gut, but maybe a better way to say that is trusting my characters. So letting them speak. Often I would go to write a chapter and I would start by thinking, okay, this is going to be a scene with Zeta and Rachel and they're in the kitchen. And I think they're going to start with this. And I thought I might have an idea about where the scene was going, but I didn't. And in fact, the characters ended up teaching me where they wanted to go. And literally as I was writing, I was surprised. Like, oh, I didn't expect Zeta to say that. I didn't expect him to get so upset. I didn't expect Rachel to storm out or to cry. And I would be surprised. And I think what I had to learn was to trust that. So when I say trust my gut, I think what I mean is like trust that the story will unfold in a way that I can maybe follow and not be so controlling over. And that was a surprise to me too. I think it's the most surprising aspect of the writing process was realizing that characters often tell you where they want to go.
Well, Jodi, this has been a lot of fun talking to you, and certainly best of luck with the book. I definitely hope you can make it to some festivals and get your stuff out there. I think that's such an important part of the process is getting out there and meeting the folks that you kind of touch through the book. You can go to jodirosenfeld.com, JODIROSENFELD.com for more information. You can buy the book there. You can learn more about the author and follow her socials. And Jodi, thanks again.
Thanks, Max. I really appreciate the time. Thank you.
Picture this. You finished your first book and nailed it. The plot, the characters, all the twists and turns. This one's a winner, and all you need is the right cover. If you've got my art skills, this is the part where panic usually sets in. Enter the cover villain, hero to writers everywhere. Founded by noted author Remy Flagg, Cover Villain focuses on composite image covers for science fiction and fantasy writers. Give them the details, and they'll craft a cover using popular trends that everyone will want to see. But wait, you say, I've got ideas of my own. No problem, as Cover Villain loves a good collaboration. As they say, our goal is to put a little villain in every cover we make. Want to know more? Then head to covervillain.com and follow them on Facebook and Instagram.
Hey, this is singer-songwriter and mental health advocate Stephanie Mathias. Be sure to check out my single Hero Side, available on all platforms now, and listen to Citywide Blackout, your home for the best indie artists.
All right, folks, that brings this episode to a close. You can follow the show on Facebook under Citywide Blackout and Twitter and Instagram under Citywide Max. Listen to the show on Podbean, Spotify, Apple Podcasts, TuneIn, Amazon Music, and every Saturday at 10 p.m. on Boston Free Radio. As always, keep those ears open.